From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a father who says his daughter was assaulted by Larry Nassar, even as the former sports doctor was under criminal investigation by MSU police.
Everybody who enabled him should be punished. And they're just going about their day, living their normal life, working the same job they had.
Murder charges against a former Michigan State Police trooper in last summer's death of a Detroit teen.
The procedure for any officer in Michigan that I'm aware of, you do not taser someone who's driving a vehicle.
And the story of an Army platoon fighting its way through the Tet Offensive of 1968.
We're living alone. We're not sleeping. Ambush at night. Walk during the day. There is no tent. There is no sleeping bag. It is a completely animal-like experience.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, we learned that even as Michigan State University police conducted a criminal sexual conduct investigation of former doctor Larry Nassar, the university allowed him to continue seeing patients. That investigation went on for more than a year, and it appears Nassar assaulted at least 12 victims during that time. With us now is a father who says his daughter was one of those assaulted by Nassar during this time period. She is now a 16-year-old who lives in mid-Michigan, a girl who once loved gymnastics, but no longer. We are only using his first name in order to protect the family's privacy. Tony, we want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us when your daughter first saw Larry Nassar and why.
She was having back problems in 2013, and she was seen at TwistStars. And then she later seen him at MSU in 2014.
How long and how often did she see Dr. Nassar for treatment?
She's seen him several times.
Okay. And you were actually in the exam room at times, weren't you?
Every time.
What was that like? And in particular, what was he like with you and with your daughter?
Very, very friendly and outspoken. The very first time we went there, he gave her autographed Olympic memorabilia. And, I mean, his office was decorated full of stuff, Olympians and famous gymnasts.
How did that make you feel, seeing all of that memorabilia and knowing his connections to, you know, the top gymnasts in the world?
In awe. You know, my daughter was a gymnast, and it was her dream to do the sport, maybe the Olympics, definitely for college. I mean, she dedicated her life to it. When she was younger, we took her out of normal school, and she began training twice a day at TwistStars to, you know, try to achieve her dream. She was training with Jordan Weeper, who did go to the Olympics.
Was there ever any sense that something wasn't quite right? Did he ever give you that kind of feeling?
I mean, there was things he did that, you know, didn't sit right, but, you know, I'm like, who am I to judge? This is the best doctor in the world. I mean, he's treating all of the top-notch athletes.
Tony, as a parent, I am trying to put myself into your place as the headlines began and you learned the truth about Larry Nassar and how many trusting girls, just like your daughter, that he's hurt.
Oh, I was crushed. I was crushed and blamed myself because I took her there. And I sat right there while it happened.
How is your daughter now?
She's not the same person. Not at all. She's depressed all the time, sad. She doesn't have the passion for the sport that she did before. You know, she's not happy, and she can't escape it because she's left TwistStars, but she's a high school gymnast, and they practice at TwistStars. So every day she goes to practice, she has to relive everything that's happened to her, and it's just heartbreaking.
I know MSU has set up a fund and has offered to pay for counseling. Will that help your family at all?
I mean, you know, it's going to save money on counseling that I have to pay for because, you know, with my insurance, we have a deductible and therapy is not cheap. So, I mean, it will help financially, but with all the counseling she's been to, it's still, she's not the same person. It's never going to go away. So, I mean, it's a nice gesture, but the fact of the matter is it never had to happen to her. She was seen at MSU in 2014, and they never once told me that he was under investigation or have been accused of this sort of thing. What parent in their right mind would take their kid to see a doctor that's been accused of sexually assaulting young girls?
And late last week, MSU President Simon apologized to all the victims, and we had an MSU trustee saying, and I'm going to quote him, "Have comfort that I hear you and we are watching." How do you feel about the university's response, Tony?
I don't feel it was genuine at all. I mean, if you're sorry, then why do you keep trying to hide it? Why won't you own up to your mistakes? You know, nothing's being done about it. Yeah, you set money aside for counseling, but all this came out, and we've been aware of what was being done to my daughter for over a year now. Now you just now offer counseling?
What would it take, if anything, for you to feel as though justice has been served for your daughter and for your family, for you?
I feel that everybody who enabled him should be punished. And they're just going about their day, living their normal life, working the same job they had when they enabled him to do what he was doing. If me and you were together and I committed a crime, you're going to be charged as an accessory. And they all need to be punished for what they allowed him to do. Nothing's being done. There's no justice being served. Yes, he's behind bars now, but what about everybody who let him do that?
You pose tough questions, Tony. We want you to know we wish your daughter well and you well as you try to put things back together after this experience. And we want to thank you very much for honestly sharing your story with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Murder charges have been filed against a former Michigan State Police trooper who shot his taser at a 15-year-old boy as the teen was fleeing from police on an ATV. That vehicle crashed into a parked truck and killed Damon Grimes. Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy has charged former trooper Mark Bessner with one count of second-degree murder and two counts of involuntary manslaughter. We should note that second-degree murder charge carries a maximum sentence of life. Here with us now is Willie Bell. He's a member of the Detroit Board of Police Commissioners. He retired as a lieutenant from the Detroit Police Department after 32 years of service. Commissioner Bell, given that police officers are so rarely charged with murder, were you surprised by this charge?
I'm not surprised due to our prosecutor, Ken Worthy, has been very thorough and addressed issues like this in the past. Look back on Malice Green case with the two officers that were charged. But it's very significant to Detroiters because you look across this country, and even in Michigan, it's rather unusual to charge a police officer with murder in the line of duty. I support the decision that was made by the prosecutor, which is in conjunction with the spokesman for the Michigan State Police, advocating they were supportive of this decision by the prosecutor Worthy in terms of this particular matter. Due to the circumstance, I think it warrants that type of charge.
Why so?
This was a matter of a civil infraction. The person was on a AV vehicle and officers were in a scout car and they violated basic common sense and the procedure for any officer in Michigan that I'm aware of. You do not taser someone who's driving a vehicle. That is totally improper, and that led to a fatality, the person dying. Therefore, it merits that type of a charge with a thorough investigation by all concerned parties. And the bottom line is the prosecutor finally made the decision to charge.
From August 26, when Damon Grimes was killed, until now, what were people in the community saying to you about their feelings over what happened?
There have been so many discussion by individuals in the community meeting, not just in terms of my District 4, but citywide. People were very concerned about the nature of this type of activity, and they really have voiced their opinion. They were waiting on this person to be charged from day one because they look at it in terms of this wasn't totally improper. This is totally out of order. This is not acceptable for a conduct of an officer with Michigan State Police or any officer engaging in that type of behavior with a person on that type of vehicle.
How significant is it that this charge of second-degree murder has been brought against former Trooper Bessner?
I think it's very significant because it's rather unique. I think that we can appreciate it, the nature of the incident and respect for the charge. And by all means, this person will get due process in the criminal justice system as we go forward. But I'm pleased with that type of charge. I felt as though that was totally improper, not necessary. This matter could have been totally handled in a different manner. And these two officers, one only being charged, But I agree, that type of scrutiny, I know as a former police officer, I would definitely have to intervene, if all possible, in terms of what was happening with my partner. And that's something that we are concerned about, officers working together and not trying to address the issue with their partners in terms of patrol and interaction with the public.
What sort of image has the Michigan State Police had in Detroit in the past, at least among the communities and the people that you're connected with?
I think they had a good reputation. Overall, Michigan State Police present a certain image in terms of their uniform and how they conduct themselves with the public, but that has somewhat declined in the last couple of years or so that I have witnessed have so many complaints because I guess they are engaging more traffic stop and people feel as though that is not their role, that is not their responsibility, and the lack of recruitment of African Americans for the Michigan State Police, all of that's been high profile, and that image has changed, and I think that the spokesperson for the Michigan State Police recognized that and spoke to that issue, that this is a major setback for them.
What do you think could help that going forward? What could help the healing?
I think they have to be progressive in terms of their approach of dealing with Detroiters, come out more in terms of community activity, and speak to this issue. But I think the spokesperson did an excellent job of responding, and I think that reflects a change of attitude because it did not help in Detroit for the matter that Michigan State Police Director placed on Facebook. There's been a great deal of discussion that she's not sensitive to the community, and they call for her to be fired. That's from a broad base, and that did not help the image at all. So as we go forward, I think they have to be more pro-Detroit in terms of the issue. People want public safety. They want law enforcement, but they want fair and constitutional policing in the city of Detroit. And that's regardless whether the Michigan State Police or Wayne County Sheriff or DPD. They want a fair, impartial, constitutional policing in Detroit.
Willie Bell is a 32-year veteran of the DPD, Detroit Police Department, and he is now a member of the Detroit Board of Police Commissioners. Commissioner Bell, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up, sports commentator John Eubankin looks back on the year in sports in our state.
If you like mediocrity, and I mean really like it, Motown's the place for you.
That comes up in 15 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Daniel, this is our final time talking in 2017, so I want to take the chance to look back over the year. First, what do you see as the takeaways from this year for the city of Detroit, the good and the not so good?
Well, listen, I think what's happening in the city of Detroit is remarkable, and if you look at it over the space of time, it was only 3 years ago this month that Detroit exited the biggest municipal bankruptcy in American history. You wouldn't know it by looking at the city, by looking at the energy, the things that are opening, the District Detroit development from the Illich family. Dan Gilbert this month has said, we're going to finally build on the Hudson site after 20 years of it being vacant. But the energy and the gearing in the city is pretty remarkable. Mayor Duggan has won re-election. I think a lot of people expected that to happen, and it did. And clearly, he is delivering balanced budgets, which he has to do. But there is a sense that of alignment, and everybody's kind of moving in the same direction. You know, you saw that with the Amazon bid, putting that together earlier this year. Business and political leadership, city and suburban coming together. So it's not just about the city. I think it's the sense of purpose, once again, that, to borrow a phrase that the president likes, Detroit's winning again. Its car companies are seeing some of the most profitable times they've ever seen in their history. So there's a lot of possibility here. And for a place that's been down and given up for dead for so long, the way it feels to me is very optimistic.
Are we seeing a greater sense of regional identity and regional sense of alignment and pulling together?
I think so. You know, I think you can certainly look at individuals. Brooks Patterson in Oakland County is the classic example.
Who I was thinking of.
Right. But I think if you really strip it away, And you look at what Brooks is doing, not the rhetoric, not the caricature of what he was. Mm-hmm. I think you'll find that even he is on the team. He's on the bus. He is contributing. I'll give you a really great example. After the Detroit bankruptcy, a lot of us thought the next entity that might go into bankruptcy of some kind, or at least state receivership, was going to be Wayne County.
Right.
And I was on the front edge of writing about that with some of my colleagues. And, you know, we thought that as we got into it, we saw that bankruptcy might be a lot more complicated for a county for reasons I won't go into. But they got a new county executive, Warren Evans, who'd been the, I think he was chief of police. He'd been the sheriff, Wayne County sheriff. And what did he do? He said, I got a terrible financial problem here. I need to fix this. He went to Brooks Patterson and asked him for his best financial guy, his workout guy, who's famous in political circles in the state of Michigan for being, you know, Mr. Negative. I mean, always saying, this is how bad things are. His name's Bob Dadow. And Brooks willingly, happily said, sure, Bob can go work for you on a project basis and be part of your team to work out the finances of Wayne County. So fast forward, here we are. Wayne County is in a far better position. And part of that is because Warren Evans was smart enough to realize he had to assemble a team, and he assembled a team with no regard for partisanship or where those people came from. They didn't have to be good Democrats. They didn't have to be Detroiters. They didn't have to even be from Wayne County. He wanted the best team, and he put that together. And I think that's kind of emblematic of what I see happening more broadly in the community. Is you see a lot of people that are playing to their strengths. They're reaching out. Foundations are helping the public sector. The public sector is partnering with the private sector in ways we haven't seen before. And I've been covering business in and around Michigan and Detroit since the mid-90s, and I've never seen anything like it.
Now, as you referenced, the Illich family's got District Detroit going. Dan Gilbert is remaking downtown and its real estate. So we can certainly say things are shiny and bustling in downtown, Corktown, Midtown, this District Detroit. When and how does this spotlight open up to include struggling neighborhoods?
I think it already is. Couple of things. One is this is a process, and a lot of the success is starting to radiate out. You see foundations and other areas that are starting to focus on neighborhoods. Certainly Mayor Duggan, in the run-up to the election, for reasons that should be fairly obvious, was focusing a lot of City Hall's attention on neighborhoods. Well, why was he doing that? Because of the electoral advantage that that might give him in the election. But I think you're seeing more and more of that. You're going to see developments in places like around Marygrove College, which is recently dropping its undergraduate education, but there's going to be some reinvestment in and around that neighborhood. And you're going to see more of that as time goes forward. I think everybody understands that a lot of this development does need to happen in the neighborhoods. And certainly rhetorically, you're hearing that from a lot of the leadership. Proof is going to be in what actually happens. And I think we'll see that starting in 18 and into 19.
Not to give short shrift to the auto industry, but what has 2017 meant for Michigan's signature industry, do you think?
It's proven in a sense that they can compete in an all-new kind of industry. I mean, it's referred to by other people and me to some extent as auto 2.0. These companies are facing probably the most fundamental change to the auto industry since Henry Ford and the moving assembly line. And General Motors and Ford particularly are demonstrating that they can play, and that they can play against the best, the most highly capitalized companies in the world, certainly in the United States, coming out of Silicon Valley. They're having to essentially walk and chew gum at the same time, meaning they are putting enormous amounts of investment into the mobility space, into autonomy, and in traditional trucks and SUVs. So they're having to do both at the same time. And really, if you can't get your core business fixed and really running optimally, you're not going to have enough resources to invest in the next generation technologies. So one of the real stories, I think, going into next year in terms of the Detroit auto companies is going to be who's able to optimize that their business the most. And I think right now, going into the new year, you'd have to say that's General Motors, that they are optimizing their core business in a better way than Ford is. And Ford, people are looking for them to make some big game-changing decisions, I think, as early as the first quarter under new CEO Jim Hackett. And if they don't, I think a lot of people are going to say Ford is really going to start falling further behind. I don't expect that to necessarily happen because I think the pressure for them to move is going to be so great that they are going to make some tough decisions on product, getting rid of some product that really just isn't meeting the targets that they need to hit, and reinvesting in some others.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, thank you for everything in 2017. And hey, let's do it again in 2018.
And we will. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time to talk sports as we say hello to Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubacon. And we get to look back over 2017 for your take on some of the top stories in sports in our state. And I think we probably should know 2017 kind of began with the passing of Mike Ilitch in February. What a name as far as sports teams.
You can think of a few guys in Detroit who are more important to Detroit sports in the last century than Mike Ilitch.
Yeah,
based on both, of course, the Tigers as well as the Red Wings.
Yep, we remember he bought the Red Wings from Bruce Norris in 1982 for, what, $8 million?
Chump change.
Oh, they
won't buy you a forward now, by the way.
I'll tell you what. And then he bought the Tigers in 1992 from Tom Monahan, one pizza magnet to another. What did his ownership style and his deep pockets mean for both teams?
I'd give him an A-plus for three reasons. One, never played any games about moving the Tigers or the Red Wings out of Detroit when they're building new stadiums. So he was wonderful for Detroit, I think. Two, he's committed to excellence. He wanted the teams to win, not just, you know, make their money. And, of course, the Red Wings won four Stanley Cups under him and got to two World Series with the Tigers, never quite finished the job.
But, and I know they wanted to.
Exactly. And the third thing is he knew his role as an owner. You did not see him on the sidelines. You didn't see him mugging up for the camera. He had what I would call sports maturity. An Ilitch family phrase, actually, and he knew how to handle himself as an owner.
He stayed up in that owner's box. And
as you're supposed to.
You didn't see him.
He wasn't Jerry Jones. That's the point. So.
There you go. Well, 2017 brought the Red Wings a shiny new home with Little Caesars Arena, but performance-wise, how would you characterize this year for them?
Mediocre, as kind of expected, and they have no identity, no style that I can see. This is my complaint last year, of course, and it's not gotten better. And they are staying away in droves, as the phrase goes. So despite the new fancy stadium, the new arena, they are not filling that place or anywhere near it.
Who do you think is going to take the hit if this team does not make the playoffs again? I mean, they broke the cycle. They broke
right.
They broke the string of playoff appearances this year. Almost got that off their back. If they're not in next year, what do you see?
Well, Blashill for sure is gone. He's the head coach, Jeff Blashill. And that surprised me because I thought he's going to be very good, as I predicted here, and I was clearly wrong on that. Mm-hmm. He does not seem to have the team going his direction. They're not particularly tough, not particularly hardworking. They're okay at all these things. They're not lazy. There's no sense of urgency out there that I can see.
We see these where they're in the lead, and then at the end of the third, the other team equalizes and then wins in overtime. And
that's called blocking and tackling, man. Finishing your checks. It's getting the puck in deep. It's basic fundamental. How to win a game, and this team has not got it, sadly. So I think Blashill is probably his days are numbered.
There's a lot of howling on social media about Ken Holland as well and bringing Steve Yzerman in that post.
Yeah, and don't confuse playing hockey with being a general manager of it or coaching it. They're not the same things. Yzerman, God bless him, you know, Mr. Captain the whole bit. And, you know, he has been good at Tampa Bay, and he's done a good job elsewhere. So maybe he can pull this thing off. But you don't know. Ken Holland, we do know, has put in 25 years that has been glorious. Now, it's not been a great 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. so perhaps the clock is finally ticking on his account. But I still tend to be patient with him.
And then when we think of the Tigers, so many marquee names have been traded away. Well, just like Justin Verlander, who, as you say, nobody was ever happier to be a former Tiger as he goes on to help Houston get to and win the World Series. Is all of that going to pay off, do you think, in rebuilding for the future?
Nope.
Why?
I don't think Avila knows what he's doing. He's the general manager, and I am not impressed by his moves so far. They've not done a good job on almost any front that I can see, and I think Tiger fans are headed for 3 or 4 years of mediocrity.
And it sounds like you think a house cleaning's in order?
It is, but it hasn't happened yet, and Avila would not be the guy I'd pick in the first place, so I'm not sure who's making the calls there.
Let's talk about the Lions. How would you describe 2017 for the Lions?
Still more mediocrity.
We're hearing a theme here.
If you like mediocrity, and I mean really like it, Motown's the place for you.
Why? What's not working for them?
Caldwell, the coach. He's a mediocre coach. I said it before. I'll say it again. I was wrong about one of these guys, Blashill, and everyone else we've been right about. Caldwell's a mediocre coach. He's a deer in the headlights. He's not calling any plays. I don't know what he does in the sidelines. And they are a mediocre team. Now, they're also missing a few players. They're 8-6 right now. They've got to win the last two games. They could still make the playoffs. It's possible, about 25% chance or so. But it's an average team.
Is Matthew Stafford the guy to be able to take them further?
He is not quite an elite quarterback, but he's a very good quarterback. He is the highest paid man in the NFL.
He's a well-paid quarterback.
Frankly. So, you know, $100 million plus to do what he's doing. No one's... that's a more cosmic question. Nobody in the world's worth that. I don't care what you're doing. And certainly not an average, you know, above-average quarterback. He's good. He's not great.
The Pistons also got a new home at Little Caesars Arena. How do you feel they fared in 2017?
Incredibly, of all the teams, I thought might have some good news. I'd rank these guys pretty low on the list. And Stan Van Gundy, one heck of a coach. They got a shot at a playoff, a real shot at a playoff spot. They're playing tough, intelligent, defensive basketball. This is the one team out of the four that's got an identity, and you don't want to play them. They're not immensely talented, but they're tough.
Over to college football, one of, of course, the big college sports stories of the state in 2017 happened in East Lansing under Mark D'Antonio.
What did we say last year?
Go ahead.
And this is both of us.
Yeah.
We'll share this
okay.
one.
Okay.
At 3-9 last year, the sky's falling. Of course, everything's horrendous. And, you know, we said D'Antonio has not forgotten how to coach. I thought they'd be 8-4 this year. They're 9-3, even better. Mm-hmm. And the one thing we said is they've got to stay out of the papers. They had serious issues that are still running through the courts as we speak.
Yeah.
Sexual assault. This is not football we're joking about here. This is serious business. That's a whole different level. But the players, near as I can figure, have stayed out of trouble this year. And they're 9-3, and they're playing serious football again. So hats off to him.
And they're going to the Holiday Bowl December 28th against number 18 Washington State. Predictions?
Always hard to handicap these things. You don't play each other, but I'd say they've got as good a chance as Washington State does, probably better.
Over to Michigan, where once again they did not beat Michigan State. They did not beat Ohio State. Wolverines are 1-5 against those arch rivals under Jim Harbaugh. Your thoughts on the Wolverines?
They're one quarterback away from winning a bunch of games. The quarterback cost them Michigan State and cost them Ohio State, plain and simple. And God bless General Korn, nice guy, and you hate to ever be critical of college athletes. At least I do. But that was the difference. And if you're starting quarterbacks out, that's what happens.
Now, former Ole Miss quarterback Shea Patterson says he's transferring to U of M. Is that nailed down, or are there still some questions because he's not a senior?
The NCAA is making up rules as we speak, so we have no idea what's going to happen. It's impossible to predict what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. If he does slot in, Shea Patterson makes you a competitive team overnight.
Couple big sports stories that are not the one that, as you alluded to, not such a happy story was really the whole issue with former MSU sports doctor Larry Nassar pleading guilty to sexually assaulting young athletes in his care, sentenced to 60 years on federal child pornography charges. What's been in your mind as you've watched this unfold as a sports writer and as a parent?
Who was watching the shop? And look, I mean, we've got well over 100 victims have come forward. And these are smart, intelligent women who have clearly have complete credibility, near as I can figure, and all this stuff. And you get more than 100 is pretty damning. And how does that happen for decades, literally for decades? These women are now in their 20s and 30s, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Show me a system where this can go on for decades and no one throws a flag. And why, frankly, why the president still has her job is a mystery to me.
How do you think this compares with Penn State and
it's
Jerry
worse.
Sandusky?
It is absolutely worse than Sandusky. And Sandusky was horrific. Mm-hmm. And I told you before, I've been in that Center County courtroom. I saw 10 victims then in their 30s. They're 12 or 13 at the time. And you see these men with wives and jobs and kids break down before you and become 12-year-old victims. And it is horrifying. And what these women are going through by a factor of 10, more than victims that we've counted, mm-hmm. than Sandusky's. How is this not getting any national attention? How is it not resulting in serious reform? I don't know.
Well, the sentencing in Ingham and Eaton counties will be happening early next month. Victims will get their chance to make statements, so that'll be something to keep our eye on.
And let me say this also. The victims have spoken have been such clear-eyed, strong voices for what they went through, what should have happened, what they warned people about, and were not listened to. These are very impressive women who deserve our attention.
Let's end on a happy note. Two heroes of the Tigers' 84 World Series win make it to the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Let's get a little good news here.
Yes.
Yes. And, of course, Jack Morris, star pitcher in the 80s for the Tigers, as well as Alan Trammell, who never played for any other team other than the Tigers. And that was one of his goals, was to be like Al Kaline, only play for the Tigers. Both great competitors. Alan Trammell, one of my favorite individuals. I talked to him after his last game, October 1 of 1996, I think it was, and he didn't know me. I'm not a beat reporter. I'm with the Detroit News. We talked for half an hour, for 45 minutes, and he didn't owe me anything. This guy's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. It's great to see For once, there we go, Cindy Canty.
Yes.
The nice guy did not finish last. He finished first and in the Hall of Fame. Hats off, Alan Trammell.
Oh, yeah. We will say a lot of fans were kind of disappointed that Lou Whitaker didn't make it in.
It hasn't got the numbers. Trammell took a lot, many years to get in, so did Morris. They were not. They were borderline candidates at best for many years. So Whitaker's not going to get there. He should get his number retired along with Trammell, says me.
All right, John Eubacon. Happy, happy holidays. Thanks for a year's worth of fun sports talk.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
Up next, writer Doug Stanton talks about his new book on the Vietnam War, which he calls one of America's unfinished narratives.
I can't tell you the depth of feeling that a generation of Americans has that no one has ever listened to them, whatever race or creed. It's shocking.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The last American troops left Vietnam on March 29, 1973. America's direct intervention in the Vietnam War was at an end after eight bloody years and 58,220 American lives lost. The nation and those Vietnam veterans had a hard time processing and talking about this war that did not end with victory. But the vets are moving into their 70s. And time is growing shorter for them to tell their stories. Traverse City author Doug Stanton brings us a story of an Army recon platoon fighting its way through the Tet Offensive of 1968. His latest book, Odyssey of Echo Company, brings us the Vietnam War through the eyes of a young paratrooper named Stan Parker, and what a story it is. I spoke with him earlier this year. Doug Stanton, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Well, you have explored the sinking of the Indianapolis in World War II with your book In Harm's Way. That was the 900 sailors facing sharks in the elements and floating for 4 days. Only 317 survived. Your book Horse Soldiers, about that small, tough band of American soldiers who fought the Taliban in Afghanistan on horseback. What turned your attention to the Vietnam War and to Echo Company?
I met Stanley Parker, the son of an iron worker from Gary, Indiana, in a helicopter in Afghanistan researching horse soldiers. I was standing at the ramp. We were trying to go to the Pakistan border. I was hoping to live with a special forces camp for a couple of days. And this older soldier had asked me if I'd written In Harm's Way, my World War II story, which I see as a survival story. I'm interested in those existential moments when we can peer into someone's soul and realize what it means to try to be human in an inhumane environment, essentially.
That's true survival.
Right. Stanley had read that book, and he said, would you write about Vietnam? It's 2005. We're flying over Afghanistan. And I said, I don't think so. I don't think America is ready to really hear the Vietnam story in the midst of these two other wars, including Iraq. So time passed as it does. I lectured in Colorado at the Air Force Academy, and we began a correspondence. And thus began the odyssey, my own odyssey, to write the book, The Odyssey of Echo Company, because I really felt it's a journey for Stan Parker from the Midwest through boyhood into Vietnam. He comes home, and the homecoming is so important. This book, in some ways, I hope, is a homecoming. And then we go back to Vietnam with Stan in 2014, and something happens, which really, I think, snaps the book into focus.
I found it interesting, as this percolated in your mind, you finally felt ready, and when you reached out to Stan, he said, everybody's ready to talk now.
Yeah, he had been thinking of this for years. This is why I think America needs to listen now, and why I think Vietnam is one of our unfinished narratives for us as a country. You and I can talk about World War II very easily, and even the Civil War, but when we come to Vietnam, what's our frame of reference? And I try to separate the soldier from the war in this. You don't have to really like Vietnam, but who does? And you don't have to dislike it either. You just simply have to be in witness of the story and listen, because I think all of us need to listen. This book is about acknowledgement and citizenship in a way. It's just an act of witness. And we have so many other veterans coming home from other wars, men and women, and they're going to need the same kind of attention. So it's a book about storytelling.
Let's talk about Echo Company and its men. Now, these were Screaming Eagles, the 101st Airborne, and their job was particularly risky, wasn't it?
It's very risky because they're the reconnaissance platoon of a battalion. So there are four other companies in the battalion. So let's say you and I are part of the platoon. We'd say, let's go downtown, see what's going on. We'll radio back to headquarters here. And if it's good or bad, we'll make a decision. But we're out there on our own, and we're highly trained but really ill-prepared for what happens in this thing called the Tet Offensive.
It's pretty heartbreaking as you read Stan's journey from this gung-ho kid who signed up right after high school, and he could not wait to get in. And you see the realities of combat and what it does to him.
You know what? You're right. Yeah, and you think, well, why would he sign up? Well, traveling around the country and interviewing, here they are, the sons of World War II, and the daughters, by the way. So Stan's father had been in World War II 21 years earlier. So we're 17 years on, essentially, from 9/11, 16. And that influences our daily life so much. So we just want to remember for a moment, 1966, while there is protest in America, 67 and 68 are the boiling points. And very quickly, the world changes. It's not a war they're prepared for.
Not a war that their fathers could relate to.
Right.
The ones who fought in Korea, the ones who fought in World War II.
They are prepared for the war, but they're not prepared for its tempo and chaos. I mean, they're highly trained. They have to first enlist in the Army, which they did, and then volunteer for the recon platoon. But it's asymmetrical. We're not taking ground. How are we keeping score? It's through the body count. We're living alone. We're not sleeping. Ambush at night. Walk during the day. There is no tent. There is no sleeping bag. It is a completely animal-like experience. And you're 19 years old, and the helicopter is taking us from point A to point B in a matter of a day to six different locations. I think the book, if anything, attempts to order chaos. And this brings us today, Cynthia. When you ask a Vietnam veteran what happened, often they don't know how to begin to talk about it. And if you can't tell your story, it's not your story because you don't have the story. And so this is what I think with the Ken Burns documentary and so many things that are 50th anniversary that we can reflect on today.
Remind us again, especially for those who were not around when this was in the headlines, what happened with the Tet Offensive in 1968?
So the war had been supposedly going somewhat well. It really hadn't. I mean,
but that's what the folks at home in America were being told.
Right. It was tough. We won't crunch the numbers right here, but President Johnson and General Westmoreland, for instance, had promised that there was light at this end of this tunnel, that things were trending upward. On January 30th and 31st of 1968, you know, say months after these promises back in the States, some 100,000 enemy troops had simultaneously attacked throughout the country.
At a time when they had said they wanted a truce for their holiday.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
So how could this be? How could this be true and happen at the same time we're quote, beating them? And so the disparity, the dissonance between that statement and those images, which I wasn't old enough to really have this focused in my consciousness, and part of the book is trying to figure this out for myself, but those images on the television screen of this happening around the country were so unsettling to America that strategically the North Vietnamese had a turning point here. Tactically, they lost. The Viet Cong were crushed. The MVA were suffering enormous losses, by the way, in bombing. It was not as if they were a robust force here that was not feeling any pain. They were. But the Tet came out of nowhere, and Walter Cronkite took off his glasses on the air and said, things aren't as well as we thought. And guess what happened next? President Johnson decides not to run for re-election.
The whole public opinion at home,
right.
That was, as you say, a watershed moment.
Right, exactly.
How did Stan and the other men in his unit, how did they come to view this war that they were fighting and dying in? Kind of give us a sense of those gung-ho kids in basic training and then their journey.
Almost like any other soldier in any war, I want to point out. But in particular, there are letters in the book that are on the pages. You can read Stan saying, we're going to go get him. General Westmoreland says we're winning. And 3, 4, 5 months later, he's really fighting like all soldiers for the person next to him, and he's fighting to get home in this case. So I imagine the first boot coming out of the first helicopter, stepping down into the ground and pushing off. And at that point, that young man is innocent. and he thinks that he's stepping towards victory, quickly those steps become nothing more than a journey home. And that journey takes 50 years, actually. And it's taking 50 years for so many of us that we meet at the library and the movie line. Anybody who's 70 is thinking about Vietnam. And if you don't believe that, just go up and ask a question. And if you're 40 or if you're 20, you're still in a family that's thinking about Vietnam, because everyone knows somebody who was there, as Michael Hare says in his great book, Dispatches. And this is why I think it's an important story to tell.
I'm talking with Doug Stanton, the author of The Odyssey of Echo Company, looking at the 1968 Tet Offensive and the battle to survive the Vietnam War. What was Recon Platoon's casualty rate? You kind of opened the book with it. It was pretty ferocious.
Yeah, they had a high in, what did I say, 80%, 74% casualty rate. So, and Stan Parker was wounded three times. Three of the personnel were killed, which was David Fravel, Charlie Pyle, and Daryl Lintner. Those deaths, what's so heartbreaking and both poignant is the privacy of the terror and the small homages that the guys paid to each other.
Do you mean by privacy of the terror?
Well, no one remembers Charlie Pyle or Daryl Lintner.
Isn't that true in every war? When you think of all the...
That is the terror of the war. Then it's the private... What's terrible about it is how private it is and how the loss of that person will never live again. And these guys, and like I say, our neighbors come home having experienced this, and they're thinking about it. It's like Vietnam is our secret. I met a gentleman in Raleigh, North Carolina recently who had been executive of a Fortune 500 company. He said, I quickly learned not to tell anyone on the board that I had been in Vietnam. Now, he had not, you know, his tour had been harrowing, but... He'd come home like every other soldier from every other war, but the community messaging was, we don't want to know. So that is a national shame. Why should that be? Why should that guy, all the energy he's spending keeping that secret is energy he's not doing something else with in his life?
It's like that open program on the computer going,
right.
Always drawing energy. Speaking of that adjustment home, I'd love if you'd read an excerpt from The Odyssey of Echo Company that really kind of very eloquently addresses that feeling of disconnect when they come home. Set it up for us.
Sure. Dwight Lane is returning to rural Indiana. He's been a member of Reconnaissance Platoon with Stanley Parker and a fellow named Charlie Pyle, who was killed in March of 1968 and whose death is a marker. You know what? We'd be sitting around and, hey, this happened after Charlie died, or this happened before Charlie died. And this is how we keep time in war. And I wanted to note Dwight's own honoring of Charlie's memory. Returning home, Dwight Lane tries to make sense of Charlie Pyle's death and discovers, as far as he can tell, that there isn't any. It happened. Charlie died. This is the best he can come up with. Dwight had joined the Army to escape Indiana and see the world. Growing up, he often wondered about the scars his father had gotten in World War II, which the old man never talked about. It will be years on his father's deathbed, in fact, before his father will tell Dwight what he thinks of that war, marching across Europe, the bodies that will spring up in his field of vision years later, back in Indiana, when he's idling along in his life, being Dwight's father. But if Dwight had been able, as he knelt in the rice paddy with Charlie Pyle in his arms, Dwight would have chosen, with all of his might, at that moment, to slide forward in time and come to rest at his father's deathbed. And he would have been close to his father's lips and listened as the old man explained how to understand the death of Charlie Pyle. What would his father have told him, he wonders? Accept it? Move on? Accept death? He doesn't know what his father would have said, and he knows that he never will. The truth is, the platoon loved Charlie Pyle in those moments when he was alive with them, and then he was gone. After the war, few look for his family, for his friends. They never look for sign of him after the war. They remember him, though. They remember him. They never forget.
Doug Stanton reading an excerpt from The Odyssey of Echo Company. As you talk about this book, what surprises you? What jumps out at you as far as the reactions people have to talking about this war?
I'm surprised, though I shouldn't be, it's true of my other books, that women are buying this book, because what it is they're eavesdropping by proxy on what grandfather did, father, uncle, brother. And And, you know, the American male opens up around 70. He loosens up. You know, Tom Brokaw discovered this. But women are much more advanced than men, and they do this earlier in life, and they're willing. They're actually, their steel is harder, and so they're able to confront this story, and they want to know. And that's what surprised me is just that.
Yeah, because certainly Brokaw was able to get those memories in The Greatest Generation from the World War II soldiers, Stephen Ambrose with, for example, Citizen Soldiers and Band of Brothers. There's something about reaching that 70-something mark where you kind of realize time is running out and you don't have forever to let this get out. What did telling his story do to you for Stan Parker?
It made me realize that we don't have to solve the world's problems, but we do have to, I think, engage and listen to them. I mean, we can't solve them. We do have to solve them, but how can we? And there is so much going on in the world right now, and I've written 3 books about combat. But what I realized that these veterans in particular, let's not even use the word veteran, these people, this is a book about people, wanted to be acknowledged. And they didn't want me to either accept or reject them. They prefer that I not reject them. But the fact that I was listening, what you asked surprised me, I can't tell you the depth of feeling that a generation of Americans has that no one has ever listened to them, whatever race or creed. And it's shocking. And it is like this other substrate of story floating through our consciousness among all the other chaos that's going on that I think is worthy of exploration. Stan Parker, 18 years after he comes home from Vietnam, is getting gas in Colorado, and a gentleman walks up and says, "Were you in Vietnam?" because he sees his cap. Stan says, "Yes." He's shocked by the question, "May I buy your gas?" That was the first time anyone in Stan Parker's life had said the word Vietnam to him, other than a World War II veteran when shortly after he came home, met him at the mailbox, retrieving his own mail. Stan said, "Hey, how you doing?" The guy said, "Well, I haven't seen you in a while, Stan Parker." And he said, "Well, I've been over in Vietnam." And the guy said, "Well, that's okay. We don't need to talk about that." And he went back into his house. So however you felt about the war, it does not matter. What matters is the humanity of our fellow citizens and the pain that we're all carrying, and in this case, because of the Vietnam War. And so what surprised me is just my lack of awareness of that.
And when you think of the legacy of this war, Doug, how does what happened there 50 years ago still impact our military, our foreign policy, and our psyche as Americans?
Well, I mean, in some ways, the fact that we left Vietnam not as the as our usual victor cautioned us against future wars. We're always fighting the last war, they say. I will say that my book, Horse Soldiers, is about another American experiment in counterinsurgency that was successful. So maybe we learned from those lessons. But I want to say that I think, first of all, it's the way we treat people returning from combat today. The great lesson from Vietnam is to separate the war from the soldier. If you look at Colin Powell's 2003 speech to the UN about weapons of mass destruction, most people I know in intelligence, you know, say they weren't there in the way we thought. Just compare that to the Gulf and Tonkin resolution in 64, another political reason to go into war, both of them spurious. Well, we treat the two veterans of those two different contexts very differently. But why? I mean, that's the question, and we won't answer it here, but we should reflect on that.
The Odyssey of Echo Company, Doug Stanton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There is so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours, we cannot possibly know about it all, and that's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you've got a question about Michigan, something or someone you've always wondered about, just send it along by going to the MI Curious page at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.